Welcome to the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh's Case Notes podcast. Over the next few months, we're going to work our way around the body head to toe, exploring different body parts and organs and their history in a cultural, medical, social sense. We're going to hear from a historian or curator about their work studying these body parts and their history. And we'll finish up each episode by exploring some of the recipes that were developed in history to treat that part of the body. So hello and welcome to the Head to Toe podcast as we make our way around the body. My name is Daisy Cunningham and I am the college's heritage manager.
And my name's Olivia Howarth and I'm a volunteer with the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh Heritage.
And today we've made it as far as the throat. When we say we've made it as far as the throat is also just sort of things that are in the neck area?
That bit. The bit between the head and the chest.
Thank you very much. Bit of technical science from Olivia there. So one of the big associations with the throat is what is called globus hystericus. Right back to ancient Greece and sort of up to the end of the 1700s, there's an idea that one of the main symptoms of hysteria was this thing, globus hystericus. It relates to the idea of the wandering womb. So one of the causes of hysteria being that the womb would move around the body and sort of strangely affect organs along the way. And globus hystericus was when the womb would wander into the throat. You'd have a feeling like a lump in your throat, like you couldn't swallow. And that was caused by blockage by the womb. Now, obviously, over time, the idea of it literally being the womb dissipated, but hysteria still had this association with the lump in the throat.
I should have dove in more to lump in the throat, but I did look into frog in the throat. Whilst there are some historians that think that frog may be frog slime, the phrase frog in the throat doesn't appear to have anything to do with that. It's more to do with having something in your throat that prevents you from saying things. So in 1847, an American clergyman published a book called How to Be a Man, and he urged young men to say no to improper diversions, describing a blockage that might prevent them from saying no as a frog in their throat, and encourage them to practice saying no so that they didn't get the frog in their throat. And then in 1894, there's an advertisement for a sore throat lozenge that was given the name frog in your throat. In French, they don't say frog, they say cat. Avoir un chat dans la gorge.
Cat in the throat.
Yeah. Well,
somehow, frog in the throat, although it is a ridiculous phrase, seems right just because I'm used to it. My brain went exactly where your brain went when you started talking. I've seen so many, both frog treatments and also frog spawn is something that's used in medicine quite a bit.
I'm sure when we talked about the womb, that had sort of connotations. There was the womb toad. So if there is a relation there between wandering womb and amphibians, they're just all over the place.
That is very true. So sort of following on from what you were saying about the power to say no, one of the things I delved into a little bit was in relation to public speaking. And I started looking at the sort of history of public speaking, which goes right back to ancient Greece, the idea of teaching people public speaking. Although it looks like in ancient Greece, they're much more interested in what you say. There isn't nearly as much study of how you say it. And then it's sort of Cicero in ancient Rome before they really start looking at how you persuade people or how you use your voice itself to persuade people. And then I ended up with Margaret Thatcher. I don't know if you've looked into this at all as well. The idea that women who have higher voices are taken less seriously. And there's quite a lot of studies that show that this is the case. Higher pitched voice, you know, in a workplace or on the television isn't considered to have the same level of gravitas. And the argument is, you know, some of that could literally just come back to sexism, but also some of it could be the association with higher voices and people who are very young, people who are inexperienced, that it has an age connection. But the reason I bring up Margaret Thatcher is she had voice coaching from the National Theatre's voice coach. So she was aware that her voice was too high to be taken seriously. So she very intentionally trained to have her voice be as deep as we are used to hearing it on television.
I was looking at the vocal cords or folds as well. And actually, the term vocal cords was coined by a French anatomist, Antoine Ferrin, in 1741, which was an analogy to do with the violin. And he believed that moving air across the vocal cords acted like a bow on strings.
Yeah. It's a very nice analogy.
It's much nicer than what they actually are.
But yeah, sort of sticking with vocal cords for a second, I read this really interesting Australian study by a lady called Cecilia Pemberton. And what she had done is compare different recordings of women, you know, from the sort of earliest recordings that exist right up to now. And her study found that women's voices are consistently getting deeper. Obviously, you know, it's not really a long enough period of time for vocal cords to literally be changing. So there is an element where people are putting on a voice, but they are putting on a voice so much of the time that it becomes, it's effectively their voice. Probably the source of it is that as women are getting more status, as women are getting more senior roles, as women are being on the television and radio more, they are adopting the voice that will give them status or will put them in the place that they need to be in.
I would have thought it was something more to do with something physiological, but it's interesting that it's potentially more psychological.
It would be interesting, I suppose, to see, are people changing their pitch in different contexts? So are they deeper in the workplace? And then when they are socializing with female friends, is the pitch specific to certain situations?
Oh, well, everyone's got a telephone voice, so I don't doubt it.
Our Physicians Gallery has an exhibition on at the moment about the history of death. And so I had to bring a bit of that into this. So another thing I was looking into was the funeral mute. Olivia has a quizzical facial expression. Yes, a funeral mute. You would employ a funeral mute. So this reaches its peak in the Victorian era, where if you are wealthy, you know, funerals become very extravagant. And one of the things that you would do is hire a mute or two for the occasion. This person is not actually unable to speak. They are paid to be a professional mute. And they are essentially a paid mourner. And their job is to stand outside the house where the body is. And then they would walk with the coffin to the funeral. They had a very specific costume they would wear. So there's a black sash, a black beaver hat with cloth on it. And when the funeral was a child's, all of this would be white instead of black. Usually it was men, sometimes it was children, and Oliver Twist has one of his side hustles is being a mute for children's funerals. Really, the defining thing of being a funeral mute is not talking. Standing outside somebody's house all night, just standing there like a soldier on guard, was pretty boring. So if you had less money, you got a less good mute, and they would have a tendency to just drink heavily and maybe not be as mute as they were supposed to be. But it went out of fashion in the sort of second half of the 1800s. It was sort of viewed as, I mean, understandably, a bit phony, a bit false. But I find it kind of fascinating that, yeah, it wasn't a good send-off unless you had a mute.
I've heard of people employing wailing women at funerals, but I've never heard of people employing people to be silent. It just blows my mind. A lot more socially acceptable, perhaps.
Especially in Victorian society, the funeral mute sort of fits. I think the keeling or wailing woman, you know, that brings out the sort of the feelings and the emotion. That's sort of part of the idea of it. And that's not what the Victorians are about at all. But yeah, you're right. You've got the sort of the wailing on the one hand and then never speaking on the other, and it's very much the two extremes of funeral practices, certainly.
So there's a strange phrase, throat distemper, which when I heard it, I was like, is that something to do with dogs? Because I know animals get distemper, which is a bizarre phrase in itself. But actually, the term throat distemper was used in the 17th and 19th century before advances in medicine allowed for specific infections to be identified. So it sort of covered diseases like diphtheria and scarlet fever. And in the 1730s, the great throat distemper spread across New England, which I think they now believe to be diphtheria. And it affected children more often than not. And across New England, about 5,000 people died of diphtheria between 1735 and 1740, which was about 22 in every 1,000 people. Scary stuff.
When I hear the word distemper, what it makes me think is that in the sort of 1500s or 1600s, they have a lot of those big bucket terms, because as you say, they haven't figured out what individual diseases are. So you'd get in the sort of bills of mortality in London, they'd just be like, ah, died of a distemper of the brain. And then over time, things are sort of separated off. So distemper is almost whatever's left once you've removed the actual diseases. It's like going, oh, I've got a vague sort of pain and I don't really know what it is.
Well, I think this one, there were some pamphlets going around which suggested the disease might have resulted from impious behaviour. And then the Boston Gazette offered treatment advice, which obviously included bloodletting, but specifically a vein under the tongue, bathing the throat in borax or honey, and then putting blisters under the arms.
But you feel like they'd have all of the same list of treatments if everyone had a bad leg or something, you know?
It's yeah.
Just do the usual stuff, basically.
There's a painting. So I looked into the throat, the symbolism of the throat. Funnily enough, that's too specific, really. But there is quite a lot about the neck in art, specifically. There's currently a woman doing a research project into necks and shoulders in art at Oxford University. Quite interesting. But generally speaking, the expression of femininity in paintings is through elegant, elongating necks and sloping shoulders. However, there is one painting in particular, which would be very interesting for people to look up, called The Madonna with the Long Neck. So it's a famous painting by an Italian painter called Parmigiano, which has nothing to do with Parmesan. And in an attempt to make Mary look kind of graceful and elegant, she's got a very long neck, which some have argued kind of makes her look a bit swan-like. But it's all to do with the style of painting as well. It's like mannerism, where figures normally have strangely elongated limbs and slightly smaller heads and slightly odd poses. So it's quite interesting that it's still called the Madonna with the long neck, despite the fact that it's, you know, of its style.
I was going to say, as you started speaking, I was going to say, for some reason I have stuck in my head, yes, specifically swan-like, which when you sort of mentally picture it, actually is not something you'd want on a human person. Could she even hold her head up, or would she just sort of fall to one side?
Maybe that's why they've got really small heads as well in mannerist paintings, just kind of balance it out.
I mean, I think part of it is obviously this, you know, the ideas around beauty and attractiveness, but also with women particularly, what is attractive is a woman looking like she's never had to go outside or work a day in her life. She looks like she sort of sits in a chair and just looks beautiful and doesn't have to do the washing up.
Some bits about hiccups. So just some superstitions about hiccups. Just because they're quite fun.
Give me some superstitions about hiccups.
Hiccups are a sign that someone who doesn't like you has complained about you to someone else. When you start hiccuping, it's possibly a sign that you're possessed by the devil.
Is there anything that can't be a sign that you're possessed by the devil? It feels like the list of things that is long.
According to Russian superstition, having a bout of hiccups means that someone is thinking about you, and to stop it, you have to say the names of your friends who might have had you in their thoughts. And if it stops after a certain name, that's the person that's caused hiccups. And then the longest recorded case of hiccups, according to the Guinness World Book of Records, was Charlie Osborne, who had hiccups for 68 years from 1922 to 1990.
That seems like that probably defined his entire life.
It's a good job he got in the world record books.
But yeah, no, at least he got something out of it. In our case study today, we're going to explore one particular type of throat candy, the Pontefract cake. This sweet had a myriad of supposed medical uses, and treating sore throats was one of them. Pontefract cakes are small, round, black sweets made of licorice. They have their name because they were originally manufactured in the Yorkshire town of Pontefract. Exactly how licorice first arrived in England isn't known for sure, although it has been hypothesised that an order of monks brought it back after accompanying crusaders to the Middle East, where it was already a popular foodstuff and drink. It is likely that the monks then grew licorice in their garden at the Pontefract Monastery,
Without the hot weather the licorice plant was used to in its natural environment, it did not flower in England. But that wasn't a problem, because it was grown for its root, not for its flowers. After Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries, the land was sold off and the monks ejected. Local farmers bought the land and continued to grow licorice on it. Although the secret of licorice cultivation spread throughout the country, Pontefract remained the centre of it. This was partially because not all soil was suited to its growth. The plants needed deep and sandy soil, often 4 or 5 feet of soft sandy soil, and Pontefract was one of the few places with ideal conditions. Early uses included extracting the sap from the roots to make a sort of cough mixture, but the first evidence of them being fashioned into the now standard round cake form was in the 1600s. Around 1760, a local apothecary, George Dunhill, developed a version of the Pontefract cake that contained sugar. Previously, the main way that a Pontefract cake had been ingested was dissolved in water rather than eaten. The addition of sugar, however, transformed this medicine from a sour-tasting dissolvable treatment to a chewable sweet which people would choose to eat even when they weren't sick. This really kick-started the mass production of Pontefract cakes. At its peak, there were over 50 different licorice growers in Pontefract, and over 9,000 people were employed in the town's licorice factories. They produced not only Pontefract cakes, but licorice tea and licorice-flavoured tobacco. This short clip, which is courtesy of the Wellcome Trust, is from an interview which took place in 2011. In it, Christine Stammers talks about her experiences of childhood ill health.
Do you have any memories of childhood illnesses at all?
Yes, I have a lot of memories of childhood illnesses. I can remember having measles, chickenpox, whooping cough, probably German measles, but I'm not sure. I can remember possibly having rheumatic fever when I was about 12. I think that's... Oh, I remember having constant sore throats. I had septic sore throats, which were actually treated with a stuff called gentian violet. My father had a paintbrush and he used to dip it in the pot and then paint the back of my throat with this purple stuff, and that was a treatment for chronic sore throats.
Can you repeat the name of that?
Gentian violet.
And where did your father get that from?
I think he had it prescribed by the doctor.
And could you describe the jar?
It was one of those little blue jars with ribbing on the outside, and it's probably six-sided, and the blue ribbed jars were blue and ribbed because they contained poison, and so you weren't allowed to swallow it, but you still had it painted on your throat on the inside.
And how large was the jar?
About 3 inches. I'm still in the inch century.
And what sort of brush was it?
It was a long angle brush. Wooden brush with long whiskers. Whiskers are probably about an inch and a half long. Gee, I'd forgotten all about that.
And how did it feel when your father's painting it on?
Well, I was always desperately trying hard not to be sick, because it would make you gag, particularly if you put it in the wrong place. But I liked the attention, because my father was paying me attention, and that was nice.
And I was just thinking that your father painted it on, not your mother.
Yeah, I don't know why that was. Well, my mother was... somewhat inadequate.
Okay. So the paintbrush, did that come with the gentian violet from the doctor, do you think?
I haven't got a clue, sorry.
That's okay. And you said it came from the doctor, so you were quite poorly throughout your life as a child, so you had lots of childhood illnesses.
Yeah.
Have memories of the family doctor?
I remember the doctors. We had Dr. O'Donovan and Dr. Clement, and Dr. O'Donovan was the senior partner, and he was an absolute tyrant. And Dr. Clement was younger and much nicer looking and much more pleasant. And every time my mum used to take me, or my father used to take me to the doctors, I always longed to see Dr. Clement because he wasn't so nasty.
Welcome to Recipes of Yore. We're going to explore some unusual medical recipes from the past. The way in which the word recipes was used in the past is a bit different from how it's used today. So it could mean recipes for cooking, for medicine, or even recipes for cleaning products or cosmetics. Very few of them were treatments we would recognise in the 21st century, and certainly none of these should be tried at home. There were so many different types of problems you could have with your throat, and so many different remedies to combat them. For a sore throat, the juice of the bramble bush. For hoarseness, a mixture of gruel, treacle, port wine, and lavender oil. One recipe in a 1731 text by Peter Taylor recommended for speech hindered, quote, boil a handful of lavender in rainwater, the juice thereof often drunk and brought backwards and forwards in the mouth. Another 1700s text, John Moncrief's Poor Man's Physician, recommends for a hollow of the thorax, quote, take of the pulp of fat figs 1 ounce, of fresh butter 2 ounces, oil of sweet almonds, newly drawn without fire, 1 ounce, sugar candy, turpentine washed with barley water, given to the quantity of 3 drams, with a powder of licorice. Another recipe from John Moncrief's book recommends vinegar gargarized, or a gargarism of the concoction of barberries or of wild prunes, gargarizing being gargling. Another one for a roughness of the gorge and throttle, which means the throat and windpipe, recommends, quote, a gargarism of the juice of mustard, of milk, licking medicines of myrrh, put it under the tongue and melted the white of a raw egg, the juice of nettles, vinegar, the juice of gooseberries and common bramble, of plantain and the ashes of burnt swallows with honey, the oil of boiled frogs anointed about the throat warm with linen cloths. Thank you for listening to this Case Notes podcast. If you'd like to find out more about the work we do, you can visit our website at rcpe.ac.uk/heritage. You can also find us on Twitter at rcpeheritage, and we have a Just Giving page, rcpeheritage, linked to on our website if you'd like to support our work and help to fund future podcasts. Thank you.